From Iowa Public Radio News, I'm Ben Kiefer. This is The Exchange. This hour, we look at some new developments in journalism. First, a conversation with the co-founder of the newly created Iowa Center for Public Affairs Journalism, Stephen Barry. Then Lyle Muller of the Gazette will tell us about the new Green Gazette, an online edition of the paper available for paid subscription. Then Iowa Public Radio's John Pemble will tell us about Omaha's Silicon Prairie News, a website that writes about startup companies and creative movements. It recently launched a Des Moines edition. And finally, David Perlmutter, director of the University of Iowa School of Journalism and Mass Communication, on developments in the world of social media. That's all coming up this hour. First, a look at the news. This is The Exchange from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. This hour, we're talking about some new developments in journalism. During the second half of the show, Iowa Public Radio's John Pemble will profile a new online news organization called Silicon Prairie News. The Omaha-based startup recently launched a free Des Moines edition. I'll also speak with David Perlmutter, the director of the University of Iowa School of Journalism and Mass Communication. We'll talk about the role of online niche reporting and the culture of online media forums and comments. In just a few minutes, the editor of the Gazette, Lyle Muller, about the paper's new e-edition. But first, a recent conversation I had with Stephen Barry, a Pulitzer Prize-winning investigative journalist and now associate professor at the University of Iowa. He's also co-founder of the newly created Iowa Center for Public Affairs Journalism. I began by asking Steve Barry what led to the creation of the Iowa Center for Public Affairs Journalism.
Ben, we're creating this because we feel like we can be a major complementary force to existing news organizations and to journalism schools all over Iowa to fulfill what we think is a very important mission of journalism, which is accountability journalism, investigative and explanatory journalism, whereas we probe deeply into serious public policy questions that face the people of Iowa.
Mm-hmm. To set the stage a little bit more, because when you say investigative journalism, accountability and so forth, what has happened, and we've been reporting on it, I want in your words to tell us what has happened in the last few years, especially in the area of print investigative journalism, that has given rise to the need for something like this.
Well, I'm glad you asked that question because we deal with this issue so much it becomes second nature to us. And it's the problem is that the financial and the business model of commercial journalism is such that their newsroom budgets have been slashed very dramatically. When I left the Los Angeles Times in 2003, there were over 1,000 reporters there now. Today, they have about 500 or 600. That is a huge, huge cut in the newsroom budget. So they do not have, and news organizations all over the country do not have the manpower and the staff to invest in the quality, in-depth, probing, explanatory type of work that we intend to do at the Center for Iowa Center for Public Affairs Journalism.
Now, explain to me how this works, because obviously the Iowa Center for Public Affairs Journalism is based on a completely different model
Precisely.
Than when you were at the Los Angeles Times,
right.
Commercial journalism. So how does this model work?
We're a nonprofit. We are certified by the state of Iowa as a nonprofit organization. We will be receiving our tax-exempt status in a few months, and then we will be applying for grants from foundations. We'll be applying for independent contributions from individuals, and through that effort, we hope that we will generate enough money to hire a permanent executive director slash editor who will be a long-time, highly acclaimed, credentialed person. We also hope to gather enough money to hire, beginning with maybe two, but eventually getting up to at least six paid interns, student interns, by year three. And then as we gain our credibility, as we produce more and more quality work, we hope that this will in turn feed more interest in contributions. Eventually, as we get further down the road, we hope to develop some independent revenue streams so that we can gradually develop an endowment account so that we can build up an endowment account and eventually have some permanent funding. So it's going to be an effort. It's going to be a tough effort, but there is room for this kind of journalism. I think the people of Iowa, people all over the country, are crying out for this kind of hard-hitting, aggressive, probing type of journalism, and that's what we're going to do at iowawatch.org.
Mm-hmm. Does this, I mean, so much of the journalism that we hear in the mainstream media either skews to the left or to the right politically, and this is an answer to that partisan divide?
Absolutely. This is totally nonpartisan, and we are going to be independent. We do want to seek partnerships. Well, two kinds of relationships we want to seek with other media and with journalism schools. We want to seek formal partnerships with a handful of news organizations, commercial or nonprofit organizations. And then we also want to establish a collaboration with reporters in commercial news organizations to work on individual projects, project-by-project collaborations. We think our student interns could really gain a lot of experience and learning by working with professional journalists who are out there in the field right now.
You mentioned partnerships, and I know that one of the partnerships that you're looking into is to partner with Iowa Public Radio. What are the other types of partnerships? Name some names of sort of desirable entities in the state or other places that you would like to get together with.
I can't think of a better partner than Lyle Muller and the Cedar Rapids Gazette, other news organizations, other journalism schools. We have talked to Drake University, and I'm going to be talking to the Des Moines Register Monday. We will talk to the Iowa State University's Journalism School, too, to try to interest their students in what we're doing. We want to be Iowa journalism. We don't want to compete with any other news organization. We want to work with them. We want to complement, that is COMPLE, complement their work. We don't want to compete with them. We just want to do what they can't do. We'll even take assignments from them.
Stephen Barry is a professor of journalism and mass communication at the University of Iowa, co-founder of the Iowa Center for Public Affairs Journalism. You can find it at iowawatch.org. Stephen Barry is the winner of a Pulitzer Prize back in 1993 for investigative journalism. You gave us a great little reference there to Lyle Muller of the Gazette, waiting in the wings. Actually, he's been listening to our conversation. Lyle Muller joining us now by phone. Good afternoon, Lyle.
Good afternoon.
Now tell us, from your end, what's of interest to you when you have something springing from the earth here, this new Iowa Center for Public Affairs Journalism, to partner with? What's the appeal for you as the editor of the Gazette?
The most interesting thing to me is the journalism itself, the fact that there'll be people out there trying to learn things that ought to be told. It's no secret that the industry that we're in has gone through some turmoil in the last few years with cutbacks in staff, and the most significant part of that impact has been fewer people out there as eyes and ears to learn things and then report about it. And so with an idea like Steve has, it just seems like a natural that you could get this reporting done, first of all, and then you need to have an outlet for it. And so I just think it's a good idea to foster good, believable investigative journalism, and I do mean believable, because a lot of people are out there doing this type of thing, and they're digging into things, but you don't know about their motives, and you don't know about the point of view and the agenda that they bring to the table.
Tell us from your end, Lyle, how would this relationship work?
I think that remains to be seen. It's going to depend upon the topic and the reporting and the level of interest that we would have. There could be many, many stories that would come out of the center that we might not be interested in because of our particular audience, but there could be others that we would. And I think that's something just that would have to be worked out, because we do have reporters on staff here, too, who provide news and information for the Gazette. The thing is how much time is available for them to dig deep into things. how much do they want to delve into a story as well, and how much help could come from the center? And likewise, what ideas do people at the center bring to the table? I think it's just going to depend on each story and the type of time, resource, and interest available.
Mm. Steve Barry, tell us, what are the types of stories that you want to tell? Can you be more specific about when you say watchdog journalism or accountability or investigative journalism? Mm-hmm. Here in Iowa, do you see some areas that you would like to delve into, generally speaking?
I've got some very specific story ideas, which I will cannot reveal at this point. But generally speaking, we want to look at all subject areas. Our primary subject area, of course, will be government. We consider ourselves the people's watchdog on government, hence the name of our website, iowawatch.org.
Mm-hmm. So government at a state and municipal level or federal level, all levels?
Primarily local and state level. We will be focusing on primarily Iowa, doing stories that we hope that Iowa news organizations would be interested in. We would be looking at news organizations to see what they're interested in. We also want to look at sports issues, not beaten. We're not going to be out covering games, but we're going to be out looking at problems involving athletics, involving student scholarship, in other words, the scholarship part of the student athlete part. So we are going to be looking at all sorts of general areas. And we are going to be asking the probing questions. This will not be he said, she said journalism. Our goal is to seek as much information as we can to give the readers enough information, real information, solid information, that they can use and make up their own minds. We are not going to be an advocacy organization by any stretch of the imagination. We are going to be a fact-based organization.
Readers or viewers or listeners, because we don't really know what will be the medium that your work goes into, and it will go into all mediums.
Yeah. Thank you for making that point. I'm a print guy. And I sometimes forget to pay attention to that. But we are a multimedia organization, and even in my classroom now, we emphasize this quite a bit. We are looking for videos. We're looking for audio. We're looking for graphics. We're looking for the best way to tell this story, whether it's in print, visually, or through audio. This will be a multimedia, or we are a website, so we will be able to take advantage of the opportunities that new technology has given us.
Stephen Barry is a professor of journalism and mass communication at the University of Iowa, co-founder of the Iowa Center for Public Affairs Journalism. You can find out more at iowawatch.org. Also joined by phone by the editor of the Gazette, Lyle Muller. And we'll come back with a little bit more on this, talking about online journalism. How do you pay for serious journalism, journalism that is accountable, and fact checks, investigative journalism? We'll talk more about that when we come back. This is The Exchange from Iowa Public Radio News. Back with Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist Steve Barry, professor of journalism and mass communication at the University of Iowa, co-founder of the Iowa Center for Public Affairs Journalism, and Lyle Muller, editor of the Gazette. We're talking about the future of journalism and the center's future vision for partnering with various media organizations to fill a gap that has been caused by the troubles in commercial print journalism. I asked Steve Barry to talk about a model for the Iowa Center for Public Affairs Journalism called ProPublica, a nonprofit news agency that just won a Pulitzer Prize this year.
Well, I was just absolutely thrilled to see a nonprofit news organization win the Pulitzer. It was a shot in the arm for all of us at the center working to try to make something like this work. It shows what we can do. I think it's a message to the world that nonprofit news organizations like we're trying to establish here in Iowa has a major place to play in the future of journalism.
Lyle Muller, you must look to the ProPublica Pulitzer Prize as an inspiration as well.
Well, I think it's a sign of the future and in a sense a benchmark. and that is that you can do quality journalism in the digital world as long as you adhere to journalistic principles. And that, I think, is the key with that kind of prize.
Mm-hmm. Lyle Muller, in February, the Gazette launched an e-edition of the newspaper called the Green Gazette. Explain how this works.
This is actually a version of the printed Gazette, but it's online. So what it does is it appeals to the people who still like that newspaper experience. They go to online for news, and all of it's there, but you have to pick what you're going to click into, and perhaps there's not a hierarchy on some online pages that exist on others, where in a newspaper there's organization. You know what's on the front page, and that someone's made a judgment that that's the most important thing you ought to read that day. You know there's an opinion page. You know there's a sports section. And so what we've done is we've put this paper in digital form, and this is happening at other papers across the country as well, so that you can read it digitally. And it's not part of GazetteOnline.com, but rather its own special product.
Now, a few years ago, the Gazette put a paywall, a paid subscription, on its online content, but that was later taken away. How does this Green Gazette compare with what was tried back then?
The difference is that we wanted to charge people for virtually all of the stuff online. Well, that model just doesn't work because there are too many places that you can get free information. And there's nothing wrong with that, to tell you the truth. I do it all of the time. But there is a product called the Gazette, and people like reading the Gazette. We've had the e-edition of the Gazette on our online site as added value. And what we learned was a lot of people were opting to read the Gazette in its version online instead of purchasing the paper. And what happened is we lose some revenue then, because people aren't subscribing to the printed paper but still getting it in a version.
So what will the Green Gazette cost online?
It's I think it's like $4.95 a month. It's pretty cheap. It's like $5 a month. $4.95 a month for 7 days a week, but you can get a weekend edition for $3 a month. About 510 people have already signed up and subscribed to the paper.
It's really interesting because people in the print media have really become so used to reading the news for free online. And you must have had endless discussions in your groups about how you convince people to pay for something that they've become used to getting for free. And what arguments do you use, Lyle?
Well, our online editor certainly was worried about this. He was afraid that the Green Gazette would be seen as being GazetteOnline.com, which is a free site. You can still go to Gazette Online and get tons of information and news free. And he was worried that there'd be some spillover. People would be confused. But what we've just tried to do is old-fashioned marketing and told people that this is the Gazette except the digital form. And with the advance of things like Kindle and iPad coming out, I think it's easier for folks to grasp. You can read the Green Gazette on Kindle 2, for example.
Mm-hmm.
And so the products that exist are actually helping in that regard. But we've just told people that you're paying the cost of the expense of getting this news and information. Someone has to do this, and you want a professional doing it, and you want someone who verifies news and information.
In many ways, Lyle and Steve, this is also a tune right out of the Iowa Public Radio or Public Radio playbook, isn't it?
Yeah.
Convincing people that you don't get good journalism for nothing.
Right. Exactly. I mean, I'm really excited about Lyle's plan, I think it'll work. It appeals to me as a journalist. When I was a journalist, I worked very, very hard to put together a story that would be readable and that would resonate with readers. And now, for years, that stuff goes out there for free. So I always have this prejudice in me that I work hard. My work is worth something. I would like to see somebody pay for it. So, but at the same time, I want my work out there to be read. And so maybe the Green Edition is going to be that compromise that gets our information out there for the public good, but at the same time recognizes that journalism is hard work. It takes talented, creative, and persistent people and public-spirited people to do it, and it costs money.
Mm-hmm. Steve Barry, what do you see as the biggest hurdles you are facing in developing the Iowa Center for Public Affairs Journalism into something that is fully functioning and thriving?
I guess the most difficult problem or the challenge we face is the day-to-day grind that it's going to take to raise money. Fundraising is a new experience for me, but we will be hiring somebody who will have some experience in that. And so the constant pressure to gather funds until we can get started and have our own revenue streams, that's going to be the biggest challenge. But the most exciting challenge is that we get to go out there and do serious public affairs journalism. We don't have to worry about celebrity news. We don't have to worry about writing silly little feature story puff pieces. We can go out there and do the kind of news that people need to have in order to make democracy a functioning government system. And that's what the founding fathers had when they first created the First Amendment, is for journalism to play this role. And that's what iowawatch.org is going to do.
Okay. And, social media, of course, has taken a big part of journalism, of talk about public affairs on the web. I'm interested to see how either of you, both of you, see that social media fit into this picture in this new, brave new journalistic world. Stephen Barry.
I see social media, things like Twitter, Facebook, they have a lot of uses. As we've seen people with cell phones can give us on-the-spot information very quickly. We've seen it in a number of situations, from the revolution in Iran to the earthquakes and so forth. But it's also, things like that are also sources of information. A number of my students frequently use Twitter and Facebook to find sources of information. So that's one value. I bet Lyle has more thoughts on that himself.
Yeah, Lyle, of course, when we see a Gazette article, we also have comments. People can respond right to the article, can't they?
They sure can. They've always been able to do that with a letter to the editor, but they can do it much more easily at Gazette Online with the comments at the end of stories, and that happens with frequency. And you know, we're all trying to measure what the use of social media is. The Wednesday night meteor that people saw in the Midwest, I saw it as well. I pulled off to the side of the road. I sent out a Twitter alert, and all of a sudden people were talking about the meteor. But what I didn't know is where it landed and other types of things about the physics of that, which come with later reporting that becomes necessary. We get a lot of comments. We sometimes we publish them. Here's a good example. The Cedar Rapids city manager resigned recently, and we had stories online. The public was responding. We went in and took a look at some of the comments from the public and looked at the ones that we thought were the most responsible ones, and we published those in the next morning's newspaper as an example of what people out in the public were saying.
Mm-hmm. Well, I want to thank you both very much. It's been enlightening, talking about the future of journalism, online journalism. Lyle Muller, editor of the Gazette, Steve Barry of the University of Iowa School of Journalism and Mass Communication, co-founder of the Iowa Center for Public Affairs Journalism. Once again, you can find out more information at iowawatch.org. Thank you, gentlemen.
Thank you.
You bet.
Coming up, Iowa Public Radio's John Pemble profiles the new online news organization, Silicon Prairie News, an Omaha-based internet startup which highlights entrepreneurial movements and new technology. The group recently launched a Des Moines edition. I'll also be joined by David Perlmutter, director of the School of Journalism and Mass Communication at the University of Iowa. This is The Exchange from Iowa Public Radio News. Welcome back to The Exchange from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. This hour, we're talking about some new developments in journalism. And it's no secret that fewer and fewer of us are subscribing to newspapers. You know, the type that land on our doorsteps, or are supposed to. Instead, more and more of us are turning to online editions of papers. Besides being up to the minute, online newspapers are most often available for free. And there are new publications that don't publish on newsprint at all, that exist exclusively as free online editions. One such publication is the Silicon Prairie News, based in Omaha. It's a website that writes about startup companies and creative movements. Silicon Prairie News recently expanded their coverage by launching a Des Moines edition of their website. Iowa Public Radio's John Pemble reports.
In 2008, Dusty Davidson co-founded the website Silicon Prairie News to highlight regional entrepreneurs in the Omaha area. As he walks through Des Moines' downtown skywalk, Davidson says Omaha and Des Moines have a lot of overlapping interests for the kinds of stories his website publishes.
We do see a lot of similarities with regards to the creative class and to the entrepreneurial scenes and the tech scenes at a grassroots level amongst technologists and startups and different things. And so what we're trying to do is highlight some of those people. And we see a lot of similarities in terms of there's like factions or people are siloed. And our job is to sort of build community amongst those people and bring them together.
While Davidson is a frequent contributor and spokesperson for Silicon Prairie News, he is not employed by the publication, but he owns the company Brightmix, which provides the technical needs for SiliconPrairieNews.com. Silicon Prairie's only paid full-time staff member is managing editor Danny Schreiber.
We are, I sometimes say, a good news network. You're not going to find a negative story on our site.
Schreiber says they choose stories for their promotional value, but he says they will link to articles written by news organizations that use conventional journalism.
Do what you do best and link to the rest. We'll talk about a company, and then we'll say, did you see the write-up in the World Herald? Did you see the write-up in the Des Moines Register?
In 2009, Silicon Prairie began featuring stories from contributors outside of Omaha, like Jeff Wood from Des Moines.
It really is interesting how you marry the two, kind of social media community building with like the authoritative source of a journalist telling a story.
Silicon Prairie frequently features video and audio features, like this podcast hosted by Wood, called The PrairieCast.
Fake persona, using things like social media to be an expert in something, but really aren't.
In this PrairieCast, Wood talks about the differences and similarities between Silicon Prairie and the Des Moines Register. Over the last 2 years, the Register has been adding extra content to their online edition, like live video streams, live chats, and breaking news. Chris Snyder is the Register's assistant managing editor for digital content.
The key is, you know, the information you want in the format you want it at the time you want it. So there are still plenty of people who want that print newspaper every morning. You know, there are people who want to go to the web version of it, so that's kind of my job, is just make sure we're doing things right digitally and giving readers, you know, a good experience when they come to our digital products.
Snyder says there are no immediate plans for the Register to charge for access to their online content. Revenue models for newspapers hasn't changed much in recent years, but for publications like Silicon Prairie News, revenue is generated in other ways. In addition to banner ads, they feature sponsored articles and host events like the two-day convention Big Omaha, where representatives from nationally recognized businesses collaborate with regional entrepreneurs. Co-founder of Silicon Prairie News, Jeff Slabowski, says Big Omaha brings together the creative and business class in a part of the country often overlooked by its own residents.
I think for far too long, folks have been here and say, wow, I wish I could be in Austin or Boulder or New York or, you know, Silicon Valley. And I think Big Omaha really did a good job of saying, I can do this in Des Moines. I can do this in, you know, the Midwest. And so giving those folks, I think, motivation and the drive to follow what they're passionate about is the biggest key and the biggest takeaway for us so far.
The second annual Big Omaha convention takes place next month. This summer, Silicon Prairie News hopes to add more contributors from communities like Kansas City, as well as establish more relationships with traditional news sources across the Midwest. In Des Moines, I'm John Pemble, Iowa Public Radio News.
Thanks, John. This is The Exchange from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer, and joining me now, David Perlmutter, the director of the School of Journalism and Mass Communication at the University of Iowa. Good afternoon. Welcome to our studio.
Thank you, Ben. Good afternoon.
Let's talk a little bit about the report that we just heard, the Silicon Prairie News, a free online website that focuses on new entrepreneurial trends and new technology. What is the role of this type of journalism for the future? So solely online and a very specific focus.
I think for years to come, there's going to be lots of different experiments, lots of boutique specialty publications starting up that have a specialized market. What we've seen over the last few years is that you can find a revenue model if you provide premium content for a smaller number of people who really need that content and are willing to pay for it and think they can't find it anywhere else. That's why a lot of very local papers in small towns are still doing fine, because that's the only place anybody can go locally to find out what the high school football coach thinks about the next season. The general revenue model of larger news organizations, that's what's really being challenged. At the same time, we had our annual dinner just a few days ago, and we gave our Hall of Fame Award to Neil Brown, who's the executive editor for journalism at the St. Petersburg Times. And he pointed out a statistic that's quite commonly known in the news industry. There are more eyeballs looking at news provided by news organizations than ever before. It's just those eyeballs are in different places, and maybe they're not all watching the same spot. And it's a real challenge to also get some of those eyeballs, especially the younger ones, to pay in some way, or either direct subscription or through advertising for the news.
So when we hear often repeated that the business model, the new business model for journalism, online business model, has not been found, that's not entirely true.
It has been found. It's also been found for print publications, but the key word is people need to feel it's premium content. So, and I'm going to give an example I know a little bit about. The people of West Branch, apparently, and I know this because I had a wonderful couple of meetings with the editor of the West Branch Times, are willing to pay for the local paper in West Branch to provide them great news about West Branch. The question is whether we're willing to pay people to provide us with general news on general topics or not. And there was a famous story just recently about Newsday had invested a lot in Newsday, in the New York newspaper. It started a website and put a lot of money and invested in it. And at the end of a certain period, they found they had 33 subscribers to their online website.
Yeah.
So it's absolutely not true that suddenly online is a gold mine and that print is dead. You still have to figure out how to give people premium content.
Now, Silicon Prairie News, this online model, generates its revenue from banner ads and sponsored articles. Also, as we heard mentioned in the story, no, you won't find the negative stories here, though I guess I understood there may be links to it. Is this really something you would call news, or something that is more like public relations in the guise of news? It's in the name, Prairie or Silicon Prairie News.
Well, I would diplomatically call it a newsletter. It's in the tradition of the newsletter, industry association newsletter, informing people about developments in the industry. It has different standards than the daily, and they admit that. I also find it interesting, you know, their model, revenue model, you know, they've got one employee, and I assume they do pay a little bit for stories. But compared to Steve Barry in the previous half hour talked about the Los Angeles Times, you know, once upon a time 1,000 reporters, now I think he said 500,
yes,
600.
Yes.
They're still supporting 500 to 600 employees to give people news of the world, the nation, and Los Angeles. Silicon Prairie, very specialized niche, saying we don't have to spend that much and we're going to give this premium content.
How are we to know if, for instance, they're sponsored articles or articles that are non-sponsored? Is anybody... do you have to ethically divulge that this is a sponsored article, whether it's in a traditional newspaper, on print, or online?
Well, probably for 100 years, journalism schools have been struggling with teaching young journalists to not just print the press release that you're sent once upon a time by mail and then by fax and now as an email. So it's never been the case that journalists were absolutely pure and never were influenced by the press release or corporate information or the corporate video. It does make it more difficult now with the plethora of other specialty publications to really know what's news and what's isn't. It's almost have to pass the smell and the sight test of whether you feel this sounds right or not. Obviously, if you're reading a publication and everything is chirpy and happy, you're probably not really reading a daily newspaper.
Okay, let's talk a little bit about social media. Last time you were on, you gave us an update on that and the rapidly transforming landscape in social media, online media expanding, lots of interaction online. How significant is social media becoming? What is have you noticed in the past few months?
Well, I think we're past the stage of asking the question on its influence in particular areas, and we're just sort of standing back and seeing it's influenced everything everywhere. That is, it's almost impossible to say, well, there's social media over there, and there's traditional media, and there's real life, because it seems to be so part of almost everything that we do, even unconsciously. About a news story that we find out later was passed on originally on a blog or YouTube or Twitter, or just you're getting an update from a friend on Twitter and you just suddenly realize one day, oh, yeah, I'm actually using Twitter. That's what I find very interesting, is that the adoption curve is people aren't necessarily startlingly saying, oh, my gosh, I've just adopted a new social media technology. It's like they've just picked up a new set of keys or something like that and just start using them.
Mm-hmm. So, but what does it look like when we look at different demographics, different ages?
Yeah, you still see the stereotype to be mostly true of huge penetration in the teenagers and young adult, and then it drops off as you march through different cohorts of the population up to people of retirement age. But there's a real movement now to empower seniors to be using social media, especially in states like Iowa, where you have the phenomenon of very small rural counties, dropping population, reduced number of younger people, older people with less access to entertainment, to social services, maybe starting to use the internet for a connection. There's a lot of talk about maybe that's a sort of movement that we have to have in the prairie states to help the rural counties survive.
Mm-hmm. And where's the push coming from? From commercial entities or from municipalities?
I think municipalities are catching on to this. I think that interesting about Silicon Prairie, the gentleman talking there made this point about, well, it used to be people wanted to be part of the social media Silicon Revolution. You moved to California. The virtual office is now a reality. And so I think we in Iowa have a pitch that we can make to our young people that, you know, there are jobs out there that you can create yourself or that you can create and work for somebody in Chicago, but you can still live in Dubuque. And it's a real challenge for the state and the companies and the chambers of commerce and the educational institutions of Iowa to make that happen.
Now, most news sites have online comments. I wanted to talk to you about this because I have pretty much given up on them in most cases because I read a serious piece of journalism on a news journalism site, and then I look down at the online comments. And it seems to be, by my feel, because they are anonymous perhaps, that it's just a to and fro, tit for tat, and I don't learn much in the comments. Now, am I going to the wrong publications, or is that pretty much what I get overall everywhere?
What you see is that in specialty technological professional publications, you get a much higher end of comment because, frankly, almost everybody participating is a specialist in that area. So, for example, in the Chronicle of Higher Education, which is mostly for graduate students and professors and administrators, you don't tend to have the level of YouTube comments where people type in all caps with lots of exclamation points, misspelled every word, and curse each other. You know, so I've seen that in engineering publications, dentist publications. So, yes, Ben, you're just reading the wrong publications. Absolutely.
I guess one of the articles that comes to mind was talking about same-sex marriage, and an article on that, and it seemed to be the comments afterwards were just name-calling and added really no value to my experience as a reader. Is there a way to change that?
Yes, there is a way. I'm glad you asked. There is a way, and I've come to the point now where I have taken a 99%, I allow myself a 1% escape route of saying real name only. That is, when I make comments now anywhere, I use my real name, almost always. I say almost. And I think that that's something that a lot of publications have to look at because it's just opening the comments to anybody to say anything. First of all, I'm not convinced that actually adds anything not only to the education of your readers, but let's just get practical here. Does it add anything to your revenue model that lots of people are cursing each other? I think it drives people away from your publication. And so I'm interested in this. The Press Citizen has an experiment with real name only. I've heard about this in other publications. I think this could become a national movement where a lot of publications and every kind of website just says, let's try this. Let's see whether it has any effect, positive or negative, or just uplifts our site beyond the gutter, which it can be now.
Mm-hmm. When you look back at journalism as it's been practiced, however long you want to go back, do we have anything that resembles this anonymity that we get in the post-article comments you find online today?
Yes. I mean, people have been anonymous since the dawn of time. I'm sure there were cave graffiti that, you know, you didn't know whether Yarg or Vork painted it on the walls. But if you go back to the beginning of the Republic, we always have to remember when they talked about the press, they didn't talk about NPR or New York Times. They talked about individuals. And some of those individuals, like, for example, Benjamin Franklin, wrote under a pseudonym, a series of very caustic satirical newspaper columns. We also know that at that time, the press was extremely partisan and bitter. So it's not something necessarily new, but it's almost like the social media technology has unleashed it to just a degree we've never seen before.
And but when we do bring out this image of the so-called town square, you meet someone in the town square, you do
right.
recognize a face. So that would be
right.
the opposite.
Norman Rockwell's famous picture of a guy getting up at a town hall meeting to speak his piece. He gets up in front of his neighbors. It's obviously a church. He's going to say something. It's the symbol of freedom of speech. You notice in his pocket that he's got the measure that everybody's voting on. You see his face. You know, if I went to the Coralville or the Iowa City City Hall wearing a mask,
yeah.
I'm not sure they would allow me to speak.
That's a good point. Now, how would this be done if you're talking about another tier? So you're not talking about getting rid of the anonymous comments, but having a section where you would only be allowed in, only be allowed to make a comment online with a real name. How would that, in practical terms, work?
Well, I do think it's up to every individual publication to make the decision to whether they get rid of all anonymous comments. I don't think it's a blow against democracy to do that. That's my political opinion. But you just allow people to register, just like you almost register for anything where you have to provide your real name. Obviously, there's some limits there. You know, you can't ask people to send you their driver's license or something, but you can do it much better than we do now.
Mm-hmm. Social media has risen at the same time we've seen a dramatic rise in partisanship in the United States. Do you see any connections between those two, partisanship and the rise of social media?
One, there has always been partisanship. As I mentioned, the early press, very bitter, very divisive, people calling each other names at the time of George Washington and beyond. But you can say that qualitatively, quantitatively, social media, for good and bad, has just unleashed a tide of democracy. But with democracy comes people saying these things to each other. And you almost wonder, it's just demeaning everybody. Because I've never had anybody explain to me how it adds to democracy qualitatively to have just lots of people screaming curse words or asterisks in all caps.
Mm-hmm. Is it also, too, that social media, you will pick your chat group, depending on the views. And you're not likely, unless you're looking for a fight, to go into a group with extremely opposing views.
Yes. People tend to seek out feedback that fits. They like to hear themselves confirmed. On the other hand, there's obviously a lot of people that love to get into a tussle on the websites.
Right. Is there anything that can be done with social media or any of our new media that can have an impact on partisanship or lessen it to some degree? Because I think most people would agree it's desirable to have a more of a consensus in the middle.
Well, I'm not sure I completely agree with you there. I have no problem with partisanship. I mean, if people have strong divisions about political issues of the day, they have their right, and that's part of democracy. But the question is how that's operationalized. And you have two people screaming at each other, waving bags of bull doo-doo and hitting each other over the head, I'm not sure that adds anything to the equation.
When we look at the next, the coming elections, 2010, of course, the Supreme Court ruling that unleashes more money than was in the 2008 elections. Do you see in the 2 years that social media, new media has advanced, that you can see now over the horizon how new media will be playing a slightly different role or a new role in this coming election?
Yeah, I think more and more you're going to see social media being used as an attack vehicle to get somebody to make an accusation and plant it, perhaps even false, about candidates. You're going to see eruptions of factoids about people, planted stories, because there's always been planted stories as long as it's been journalism, but at least there was some level of filter and control of an editor and a publisher that had to take some level of responsibility. So
mm-hmm. So when Sarah Palin has a quote that comes out on her Twitter, we instead of actually being recorded or videotaped, you mean?
Yes, but also just somebody claims they heard Sarah Palin say something and puts it on his Twitter, but you don't know whether it's true or not.
But it could go viral.
And suddenly it's all over the country quoted as if it is her.
And it has more or less the same effect for her.
Yes.
Positive or negative. Let's talk quickly before we have to go about the issue of privacy online. Government officials, corporate executives, many of us struggle with it, worry about it. Last week, a report from researchers at the University of California in Berkeley, University of Pennsylvania. They have among the first quantitative studies looking at young people's attitudes towards privacy. And surprisingly, it looks like it's not that much different than older people. For instance, 80% of people of all ages said they have refused to give out information to a business because they thought it was too personal or unnecessary. Among adults, 82% have refused, compared with 85% of those over 65. So those are virtually identical.
I think young people aren't that different in that they realize there is such a concept of privacy. It's just that they may define it differently and act on it differently. We all have theories about how we and others should behave, but may practice. It's like you ask people, should you be texting and driving? Most people would say no, but then text and drive on the way home from the radio interview. I have no promise that that's what I'll be doing or anything. But.
We'll leave it there. Thank you very much and look forward to having you in our next time. David Perlmutter, the director of the University of Iowa School of Journalism and Mass Communication, thank you for taking the time for us today.
Thank you very much, Ben.
And The Exchange is produced by Alex Hoyer, Catherine Perkins, and Jeff Schmidt. Our producer assistant today, Rosalind Sixby. Technical support from Dennis Reese. Podcasting and on-demand audio of The Exchange available at iowapublicradio.org. Our theme music was composed and performed by Dan Knight. The Exchange is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.